and they could see the wall of one room pulsing with colors from a massive flat screen. Blister stepped out of the Cadillac. He leaned against a fender to balance himself while he urinated, holding the gun in one hand and his pecker in the other. Inside the limo, Buck elbowed Lane Kuhlman, testing his interest in making a run for it. Kuhlman didn't respond. He was busy trading texts with Smeg. Buck slid himself up the long bench seat until he was right behind the driver.
"Let's go," he whispered.
"Excuse me?"
"Take off, hurry."
"But, sir..."
"It's all right, go," Buck said.
The evening stillness was broken by a flame-blue flash and an ear-splitting pop. Buck dove to the floor of the car. Kuhlman landed beside him, shielding his head with both arms and squeaking like a hamster. The car door flew open and Blister Krill dove inside. He ordered the driver to hit the gas. Buck sat up, beat-faced and ranting. Blister said,
"Chill out, bro. I shot the damn mailbox is all."
"Why in the name of fuck would you do that?"
"To see what it's like. Pulling a live trigger."
Buck stared incredulously.
"This is the first time you ever fired a gun? And you live in Florida?"
Kuhlman scooted to the opposite end of the limo, as far as possible from the pistol in Blister's hand. Framed in the rearview mirror was the stoic Cuban driver, assessing his disorderly passengers. The driver's lips moved, and Blister yelled,
"What'd you say, Pablo?"
"Están grandes, pendejos," the driver repeated cordially.
"What? Talk American, goddammit."
The driver, who, of course, spoke perfect English, said,
"Where to now, gentlemen?"
Rogelio Burton hung around until the other cops were gone.
"The truth, please," he said wearily to Yancey, "for old time's sake."
"Like I said, it was a random home invasion."
The detective gestured at the splintered remnants of the for sale sign.
"You were attacked by marauding realtors?"
Yancey shrugged.
"It's a cutthroat business, Rog."
"You're full of shit. They're bouncers from South Beach."
"I knew it! Pinheads," said Mary Mansfield.
"And where were you when mild-mannered Mr. Yancey flipped out?"
Burton asked her.
"Soon as we pulled up to the house, Andrew spotted somebody inside. He told me to drop him off, wait 10 minutes, and dial 911. I only waited 5.
Burton went to the kitchen and came back with a beer.
"One for the road," he said. "I'm going home to work on my memo for the sheriff."
Yancey said, "Okay, Rog, you win. Sonny doesn't need to know about this."
"Then keep talking.
That slimy TV lawyer who bought the land next door, name's Richardson. Now he wants me to sell him my house, and I said, no way. Apparently the Calusas had a dental clinic on his property 5,000 years ago. There's sacred Indian teeth all over the place. So now Richardson can't build on the lot. What are the odds, huh?"
Burton said,
"Your neighbors always have the worst luck."
"Seems that way."
"So you think this lawyer hired those two fuckwits who broke in tonight?"
"They didn't deny it. I intend to press charges, too."
"That would make my year," Burton said.
"I sure don't want a guy like Richardson living next to me."
"You don't want anybody living next to you, Andrew, except lizards and land crabs."
"I like the deer on the island."
Mary said, "That's true. He's very fond of the deer." Burton opened the beer.
"Did you rip your stitches wailing on those bozos?"
Yancey pointed at his shirt.
"You see any blood? I'm doing just fine."
Burton turned to Mary.
"It's probably good that you're here."
"Well, I'm leaving tomorrow. Andrew won't sleep with me."
"He's not being noble. That's just an act."
"About tonight," Yancey said to Burton. "What do you plan to tell our excitable sheriff?"
As little as possible. He's got a big fundraiser tomorrow at the San Carlos.
Put me down for a dollar. After Burton left, Yancey hitched the boat trailer to his car. When he handed Mary's fleece to her, she said,
"Wait, we're seriously going fishing in the dark?"
"Not fishing." Yancey drove to the old wooden bridge lodge and put the skiff in the water. He'd brought the handheld spotlight, though he didn't need it. A bright half moon hung in a clear, deep sky. He steered with one hand and rested the other on the throttle. Mary's hair was flying everywhere, so she pulled it into a ponytail. It occurred to Yancey that in the time they'd known each other, he hadn't once seen her look at her cell phone. She never texted, tweeted, Facebooked, Instagrammed, or posted a single picture when they were together. He found this behavior alluring. The breeze was light but cool, the tide rising. No other boat was in sight. After a short ride, he staked the skiff in the shallows at Porpoise Key, a place he'd never taken Rosa. A honey glaze from the sodium lights of Miami rimmed the northern horizon. Mary said the sky was amazing.
"Where are we, Andrew?"
"Church. That's how it feels to me."
"Then we need music."
Finally, she appraised her phone, scrolling through the playlists.
"I vote for Charlie Parker."
"You're unbelievable," Yancey said. "Come sit here."
"What, you don't like Bird?"
"Bird's the best. Come here, please." Mary settled beside him on the polling platform. Due east, a stream of cars and trucks flickered on the long bridge at Bahia Honda. When Yancey was buzzed, the headlights looked like regimental fireflies. But tonight he was dead sober, adrenalized from his run-in with the bouncers.
"You miss Rosa. That's allowed," Mary said.
"Yet here I am, alone with you."
"Hey, I've been missed by guys, too. Trust me, I've broken the hardest of hearts. Dudes way tougher and hotter than you. Though I will say this, you're a good kisser even when you're not cooperating."
"Tell me why you got that tattoo."
"The AY is what's got you worried, I bet. Well, guess what? It doesn't really stand for Andrew Yancey. It stands for all yours. For when I meet the right man."
She stood up to take off the fleece. Next to vanish was her blouse, and then the cutoffs. Yancey found himself eye to eye with the perky bumblebee. "Hello, cutie," he said. She turned and lowered gently onto his lap until their faces were inches apart, and she slipped both arms around him.
"How's the boo-boo on your tummy?"
"Cured. This is better than a trip to Lourdes."
"Wait, I don't want to poke you."
She unfastened some sort of ring from one of her nipples and flicked it overboard. Yancey said, "This is the first time those pelicans ever heard a jazz saxophone." He recognized the tune as dexterity, manic and carefree.
"What pelicans, Andrew?"
"They're roosting up in the mangroves. I can show you with a spotlight."
"No, let them sleep. Tell me what's on your mind."
"Nothing. Except I haven't heard a word from her in 4 days.
"I know," said Mary. "I go through your phone at night while you're in the shower."
Yancey was annoyed at himself for not being more annoyed. He realized he was about to do the very thing that Mary had been predicting since the day she'd turned up at his house. It was tempting to blame Charlie Parker and the starry moment, but Yancey couldn't cut himself any slack. The romantic boat ride had been his idea, not Mary's. Nor could he pretend to be shocked that she'd wiggled out of her clothes. In his love life, Yancey specialized in devising scenarios that could lead only to unwise decisions. It was hard to picture an even-keeled relationship with a person who took her last name from a dead movie star and crashed automobiles half-naked for a living. Yancey himself was no paragon of dependability, as he was keenly aware. 96 hours of radio silence from a faraway girlfriend wasn't a green light to stray, yet his hands felt perfectly at home cupping another woman's bare ass. He couldn't rule out the possibility that he was a hopelessly shallow horn dog. Mary said, "I predict Rosa calls tomorrow. She's probably just skiing. The cell service is sucky in the mountains."
"You've been to Norway, have you?"
"Sugarbush. Same difference."
She shifted in a significant way on his lap. "That feels nice," he said.
"No, a puppy licking your toes feels nice. What you're experiencing, mister, is transcendental contact."
"A goner." He kissed her on the mouth. "Now you can say you told me so." Mary laughed softly.
"Men, I swear."
"You want me to stop?"
"What do you want to do, Andrew?"
"Rock the boat."
"Then hang on," she said.
Chapter 20. The sex lasted a long time. 43 minutes, according to Deb's Fitbit. 43 minutes and 167 calories. Afterward, she hit the nail salon, Starbucks, and Whole Foods. When she returned home, she was surprised to see Brock Richardson's newest Carrera still parked in the driveway. He was supposed to be at the office taping a new Petrolux litigation commercial. Deb carried the grocery bags into the kitchen, where she found him wearing a long-sleeved shirt, cross-striped necktie, and no pants. With clenched buttocks, he stood in front of a blood pressure monitor, the portable type sold at drugstores. He had placed his cock inside the compression cuff, which was emitting a deep hum.
"Wow," said Deb. "This is new."
"Something's wrong down there. It's still hard as a rock, and I can't make it go away."
"So you aren't actually boning the..."
"God, no. I just want to make sure I'm not having a damn heart attack."
He showed her the flashing numerals on the machine.
130 over 80. That means everything's okay."
"Listen to me, Brock. If you're taking your blood pressure with your wiener, you are the opposite of okay."
He unfastened the Velcro strap and carefully withdrew from the inflated sleeve. Deb put him under a cold shower for 10 minutes, yet his erection failed to flag. Next, she made him dunk his junk in a bucket of ice cubes, with the same result. She said,
"For God's sake, how much of that crap did you use?"
"Same as always."
Richardson's teeth were chattering.
"Tell the truth."
"It's all for you, babe. I did it for you."
Deb refilled her e-cig with nicotine syrup and took a drag. After the humiliating accident, she'd switched to a brand of vaporizer that was advertised as fireproof. Meanwhile, Richardson had contacted a lawyer pal and gotten her name added to a brewing class action against the manufacturer of the first device. As a gesture of devotion, he'd offered to waive his usual percentage of the settlement.
"You're not going to the office with a stiffy," Deb said. She suspected he was cheating on her with one and probably both of his brunette assistants.
"I'll wear bicycle shorts under my pants. Maybe it'll all fit."
"Don't be gross."
She grabbed a bath towel and tossed it across his groin, where it waggled like a crippled kite. She proposed a trip to the emergency room.
"Has it been 4 hours?
Richardson checked his watch.
4 hours is when they say to panic.
"Then we'll wait here together."
Deb opened a book and vaped on her plastic ciggy.
If not for her own clandestine escapades, the kayak instructor, the tantric landscaper, her stepsister's podiatrist, and so on, she would have pressed more aggressively the issue of her fiancé's infidelity.
"Swear to Christ, I'm going to quit cold turkey," Richardson vowed, referring to the Petrolux. "This is getting freaky."
Getting? Deb thought. She had mixed feelings about the potent gel. It was indisputably harmful, as evidenced by the weird baby schlongs sprouting in her lover's armpits. On the positive side, his performance in bed had become so stellar that it served to counterbalance the repellent facets of his personality. She could envision a medium-length marriage, say 5 to 7 years, based solely on the attractions of sex and money. She feared the future might not be so tolerable if Brock kicked the Petrolux habit. He had spoiled her.
"You want to do it again?" she asked. "Just for 15-20 minutes?
"I'm in. Never waste good wood." At that moment, his phone rang. He answered it and soon started pacing, still comically engorged. By the time the conversation ended, he was storming through the kitchen, shouting, "Shitheads! I'm dealing with useless, worthless, brainless shitheads!" Deb closed her book and waited. "Those two clowns I sent down to Big Pine," Richardson said, "the whole thing went to hell."
"What happened now?"
"What happened is they fucked up and got thrown in jail. But that's not the worst part," he railed. "Your engagement ring? That asshole Yancey had it all along. The mob guys took it from him, the guys Trabeau sent. Martin told me they didn't find it, but Rick says that's not true."
"Rick is?"
"One of my guys."
"Who's now locked up?"
"Classic," Deb said. "Point is, those mafia goons grabbed the ring at Yancey's house and kept it."
"Speaking of the house, he's going to sell to us, right? They smacked some sense into him."
"Are you even listening? Those goddamn guineas stole my $200,000 diamond."
"You mean my diamond," said Deb.
News of the six-figure ripoff had done what frosty testicles couldn't do, deflated Brock's boner. He stuffed himself into a pair of boxer shorts, saying, "Don't worry, I'm going to get that fucking rock back."
"We're talking about the same mafia, right? The one that kills people and hangs them on meat hooks."
Brock put on some slacks, tucked in his shirt, and fixed his tie. "Trust me, baby, I know how to deal with these mopes. I can totally get down and talk their language."
"Okay, then," she said, thinking, "I'm engaged to a dead man."
In an interview with a Brooklyn newspaper, the widow of Abdul Halim Shamoon said the authorities in Key West weren't trying hard enough to find the tattooed white man who had fatally assaulted her husband on the conch train. Mrs. Shamoon implied that the institutional prejudice against Muslims was to blame for the lack of urgency. The article was reprinted in the Key West Citizen and brought to the attention of Sheriff Sonny Summers, who regarded any controversy as a threat to his re-election. Nobody on his staff seemed to know how many Muslims were registered to vote in Monroe County, but Sonny Summers didn't wish to alienate a single one. Regardless of his or her religious leanings, any deceased tourist was bad for tourism, and anything that was bad for tourism was also bad for incumbents. The sheriff summoned Rogelio Burton, his top detective, for an update on the Shamoon investigation. Burton reported that the main suspect, Benjamin Blister Krill, was still at large and possibly traveling with Buck Nance, the wayward television star. The men were said to have left the island on a private jet the night before, a report that turned out to be false. The aircraft in question had carried only one passenger, Mr. Credence Windsor of Los Angeles.
"So Krill's still in town? Then get busy and catch the bastard," Sonny Summers said.
We'll push the conk train thing as a hate crime. You deal with the media.
Burton wasn't optimistic.
It's not a slam-dunk case. The eyewitness accounts from the scene are inconsistent, to put it kindly. Not one of them could positively ID Benny Krill from his last mugshot. The only thing they agreed on is the tattoo across his back. Hell, that's almost as good as a fingerprint. We checked the social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. There are at least 13 other white males in the country with Captain Cock tats. The sheriff said, "You're shitting me." It's a very popular TV show. So we'll have to prove all 13 of these numbnuts weren't in Key West on the afternoon Mr. Shabib was killed.
His name's Shamoon, Burton said, but you're right. We'd have to nail down 13 different alibis. Major project.
And flying them all in for the trial? That'll cost a damn fortune,
Sonny Summers muttered, even if we put them up at the Best Western. He picked up a sterling silver letter opener that had been given to him for no reason by the governor. Idly, he tested the sharpness of the point on his thumb.
Raj, did you talk to Dickinson? What's his mindset?
We might get Krill on a manslaughter, said Burton, if we're lucky. State Attorney Billy Dickinson shared the sheriff's allergy to negative headlines. Losing a high-profile homicide trial wasn't on Dickinson's bucket list.
He says the Captain Cock tat might be enough to convict, Burton said, unless Krill gets a halfway competent lawyer. Billy's afraid the other train passengers will get shredded on cross-exam. Tourists, as you know, make terrible witnesses.
Sonny Summers tapped the silver letter opener on a corner of his desk to see if it sounded like a tuning fork. It didn't.
Raj, someone should speak to the dead man's family. Make sure they know we're busting our balls to catch this guy, or whatever the Islamic word for balls is. I'll make the call, no problem. They're American, by the way. Meanwhile, explain to me why Buck Nance, a TV star, would be hanging out with a third-rate scumsucker like Benny the Blister. Where did you hear that, anyway? I thought Nance was gone from the Keys rehabbing at a desert spa somewhere. That's what he told me when he called.
Burton said, "An informant says otherwise."
Well, fuckaroo.
One other update. It's about your favorite restaurant inspector. The sheriff seemed to slump.
This campaign party at the San Carlos tonight, all these folks are bringing their checkbooks, and I need to charm the shit out of them, meaning I need to be at my personal best. Keep that in mind before you say another word.
Burton assured him that the new Yancey situation was manageable. A couple meatheads broke into his house. He put them in the hospital. The arrest report will call it a home invasion robbery. Both suspects are in the medical wing at Stock Island.
Did Yancey do anything, you know, weird to him?
Sonny Summers asked.
If he did, the media will go apeshit. No vacuum attachments this time. He clocked the intruders with a real estate sign. That makes it less of a story, right? Maybe no story.
Simple self-defense. Probably won't even make the papers. The sheriff sighed pensively.
Why would robbers target Yancey of all people? You're his friend, but you get what I mean. What has he got worth stealing? Hell, never mind. Can you please not tell me any more about this?
My pleasure, said Burton.
Be honest, what do you think of this suit for the party tonight? $165 at Men's Warehouse.
They say Seersucker's making a comeback.
Don't bullshit me, Raj. I look like fucking Matlock, the sheriff said.
You'll call the Muslims?
Right away. Make sure they know this case is my numero uno priority, same as if poor Abdul was a Christian or a Buddhist. Tell him Key West is a place that loves everyone equal, and we want everyone to love Key West.
Burton said, have fun at your fundraiser.
There's an open bar, thank God.
John David Ampergroat looked across his desk at the stylish, though drained, figure of Cree Windsor and said,
"Summation?"
"It's a shit show, Amp."
"Tell me something I don't know."
"No, I mean literally a shit show. The man wiped himself with the deal papers."
Amp leaned back, studying his fingernails for nicks. Bayou Brethren was still doing spectacularly well without Buck Nance, the younger brothers having bloomed into fully realized redneck caricatures. Miracle's illicit affair with Junior had added a magic spark of toxicity. During the most recent taping, Buddy had thrown a Dewar's bottle at Junior while Cleroy had stolen Junior's iPhone to leer at a picture of Miracle's bare ass that Junior had snapped in the outdoor shower. Meanwhile, the Nance wives were in a frothing riot of jealousy and spite. It was magnificent television.
"We don't need another damn brother in the cast," Amp said.
Cree Windsor agreed.
"This whole thing was Lane's idea?
But we also don't need Buck Nance in the same time slot on another network, being represented by another agency."
Amp was thinking out loud.
"You're the only one this psycho Spyro wants to talk with," Cree Windsor said.
"That's what Lane told me, who, by the way, has not distinguished himself."
"Rule number one, never lose control of your client."
Amp looked up from his nails and nodded.
"Or a shit show is what you get."
"Spyro's a bad dude, and not in a good way. He's scary crazy."
"You mean crazy scary?"
"Right," said Cree Windsor. "You're seriously going down to Florida to meet him?"
Amp said it was the only way to get control of the situation.
"Lane's working out the details."
"Bring some security. The biggest dude we got."
"Way ahead of you," said Amp.
"Oh, and don't forget, your aunt just died. That's why you sent me down there the first time."
"Right, right. What was her name? Did we even decide on one?"
"I don't know. Carol?"
Cree Windsor said with a shrug.
"That works. Dear old Aunt Carol."
Judging from Cree Windsor's description, the man who called himself Spyro Nance would be terrible on the show, dull-witted, mean, and uncoachable. Amp's idea was to keep him around for a couple of episodes, expose him as a fraud, and then fire him for breach of contract. The script would call for Buck to be shattered by the revelation that Spyro wasn't actually his long-lost twin. There would be tears and humiliation at the weekly barbecue, but the hardy patriarch would rally and move forward. The network had reluctantly agreed to double Buck's salary, as Lane Kuhlman had demanded, but Amp foresaw a walkout by the other Nances if they didn't receive comparable pay hikes. In theory, that could be a windfall for Platinum Artists, which represented all the family members individually. However, Amp expected the network to dig in its heels if the entire cast staged a mutiny over money. Television executives loved reality programming only because it was cheaper to produce than sitcoms and cop shows. If the Brethren payroll jumped too high, the network would simply let the Nance's contracts lapse and replace the whole greedy clan with a fresh collection of goobers. Once he was on scene in Florida, Amp planned to elbow Kuhlman offstage and take charge. Buck Nance would be steered aside and given a bracing dose of straight talk. The man calling himself Spyro would be humored and led to believe that primetime glory awaited. Amp also aimed to uncover Spyro's real name and feed it to a private investigator for a criminal background check that promised to be bountiful.
"The maniac walks around with a gun in his pants," Cree Windsor reminded Amp.
"So do half the crappy actors in Hollywood."
For a lunch break, Amp met Rachel Kuhlman at the Wilshire, where he was crushed to hear that for once she wanted only lunch. Room service delivered two Coho salmon Caesars and a bottle of white wine. Amp and Rachel sat on the edge of the king-sized bed in front of the food cart, which was draped with a linen tablecloth. Rachel kept most of her clothes on, and out of nowhere began to complain that Amp appeared to be taking Lane's side in the divorce. She implored him to make Lane return to Los Angeles so that court proceedings could resume. To salvage his chances for a quickie, Amp assured Rachel he would speak with her husband as soon as he got to Key West.
"And you'll tell him to do the right thing? Promise?"
She unfolded her legs.
"Baby, I will order him to be on the next flight home," Amp said.
Rachel smiled and took a pursed nibble of salmon.
"Nobody wants a long, drawn-out trial. Be sure and tell him that, too, okay? Hurry back to L.A. and let's get this thing settled. Then both of us can go our separate ways."
"That makes total sense."
Amp assumed the judge had refused to issue a contempt order against Lane, forcing Rachel to try a new strategy.
"A trial would be completely exhausting," she went on. "I wouldn't have the energy for anything else. I'd be so burned out."
Amp got the message and accepted his role in the Kuhlmans' court fight. He didn't want to give up his lunch times with Rachel. She was so damn hot.
"Going to trial would be crazy," he agreed. "A total nightmare for everyone except the goddamn attorneys. I'll get Lane on board, don't worry."
"I knew you'd understand."
Rachel put down her fork and with her bare heels pushed the food cart away from the bed.
"How about some dessert? You still look hungry."
After Blister shot the mailbox, they sped back to the house on Fleming Street and turned off the lights. The next morning, Lane Kuhlman ordered a different limo. When a white superstretch arrived, he sent it away.
"We're not going to a prom," he said to a downcast Blister. "Let's get something shorter than a city block."
They ended up in a standard black Yukon with non-pimp rims. The new driver was another Cuban, which elicited from Blister a vile monologue on America's self-destructive immigration policies. He got bummed when Buck wouldn't chime in. Eventually, the driver had enough and spoke up.
"Sir, I was born in New Jersey. I'm a U.S. citizen just like you."
Blister hurled himself halfway over the front seat, snarling,
"Hey, Pablo, you ain't just like me, and your people sure as hell ain't like my people. Tell him, Buck."
"Quiet," said Captain Cock.
"What?"
"Just shut up." Blister sat back, fuming and confused. Buck was no fan of Hispanics, but he couldn't bear listening to Blister berate the driver. When Buck was a boy, he'd overheard his father speak to a Puerto Rican auto mechanic the same way, and he remembered feeling uneasy and possibly ashamed. True, he and his brothers had grown up to be racist dickheads like their old man, but they weren't in-your-face racist dickheads. Had Buck not been so flustered that night on stage at the Parched Pirate, he would never have blurted those crude jokes, not with muscular gays and Negroes in attendance.
"What'd you say your real name was?"
Blister asked him gruffly.
"Matt Romberg."
"Is that Jewish? You a Jew?"
"German Lutheran," Buck replied.
"Sure about that?"
Buck wondered how Blister Krill had survived to middle age in a place as ethnically diverse and gun-crazy as Florida. He was confronted with the possibility that Blister had been a different person before becoming obsessed with Bayou Brethren. It was one thing to market a television program to attract low-class shit-kickers. It was another thing to create them. Buck surmised that the pirated outtakes of his sermons were an inflammatory factor, and he felt fairly shitty about whatever Blister did to the Muslim on the conch train. It was no better than murder. According to the newspaper, the victim had a thriving business and loving family back in New York. That didn't prove he wasn't a closet jihadist, but the article said he was carrying souvenirs at the time he was attacked. There was no mention of the police finding any weapons, a suicide vest, or even one crummy ISIS recruiting flyer.
"Get Amp on the phone right now," Buck said to Kuhlman.
"We've been texting. He promises to come."
Blister said,
"Hold on, I wasn't done talking about the Jew thing."
The stolen pistol came out once again. Buck was over it.
"Shoot me or anybody else in this car," he told Blister, "and you fail the world's easiest IQ test. Instead of a TV deal, you get life in prison."
Kuhlman said, "Come on, Spyro, put the gun away."
"Then stop messing with me."
The driver interrupted to ask if they wanted him to turn around and do it again. They'd been riding back and forth on the 7-mile bridge because Blister was entranced by the ocean hues. This would be their 7th crossing of the morning. Buck put a halt to it, saying he was starving. The driver pointedly took them to a Cuban joint for lunch. Blister didn't complain because he was hungry too. They stuffed themselves with arroz con pollo and picadillo. Kuhlman brought a sandwich to the driver in the parking lot. On their way back, traffic on the famous bridge slowed to a halt when an Airstream coach blew a tire. Buck and Kuhlman remained pegged to the back seat while Blister got out of the Yukon and leaned over the bridge rail, trying to see if there were any hammerheads swimming around the pilings. Stopped in the opposite direction, blocked from Blister's view by the broken-down Airstream, was a nondescript Subaru driven by a sanitation and safety specialist for the State Division of Hotels and Restaurants. Andrew Yancey was on his way to Marathon for a walkthrough of a Tuscan-style bistro that had a spotless inspection record, so he was in a good mood despite the delay. He turned up the radio and rolled down the windows to catch the gusts off the ocean. A cop finally showed up and laid out a pylon path for the northerly traffic to squeeze past the disabled RV. Yancey was moving no more than 10 miles an hour when he passed by Benny Krill, sprawled witlessly on the hood of a black southbound Yukon. In the back seat sat two figures that looked very much like Lane Kuhlman and Buck Nance. There was nothing for Yancey to do but keep driving, for there was no place on the long bridge to turn around. He was basically stuck on a conveyor belt going the wrong way. He didn't grab his phone and call Detective Rogelio Burton, although at some point he would. Maybe. Yancey was irked that Burton hadn't told him that Blister and the others were not aboard the gray executive jet that had departed the night before. By now, the detective surely had obtained the passenger manifest from the pretty silver-haired woman at the airport. Yancey rushed through the bistro inspection, one rusty dumpster plug, one dead gecko on a windowsill, and headed home to Big Pine. He wasn't sure Mary Mansfield would still be there, but she was, lying out in a killer chrome tank suit and a floppy hat.
"This is the stupidest thing a redhead can do. Try for a tan," she said when Yancey joined her. "It's your fault, Andrew. All that crazy boat sex scrambled my senses. Was it unforgettable? Possibly. Did it mean anything? Do not haunt yourself with that question."
"Guess who's still in the keys? The trace a-hole amigos we followed to the airport. They never got on that jet."
"Tricksters, eh?" Mary said. "Here, Mr. Sensitivity, rub some of this age-defying potion on me. Clear zinc, a zillion SPF. Like it matters anymore."
Yancey did her arms, neck, and shoulders. He confided that he couldn't stop thinking about the man that Benny Krill scared off the conch train. There was an interview with a widow in the paper. Jesus, it's so sad.
"Let it go. The cops'll catch up with Blister."
"But see, I'd like to be the one. He put a knife in me, don't forget."
Mary flicked him on the nose.
Here we go again, Andrew. This is where I remind you what Burton said, that the sheriff wants you out of the headlines, unless, deep down, you don't really care if you get your badge back.
Yancey was coming around to Rosa's view that Sonny Summers wasn't going to bring him back on the force, no matter what.
I should clean the 12-gauge, he said, just in case.
Mary tore off her hat and slapped him with it.
What is it with guys and their guns? No wonder your brainiac doctor girlfriend ran off to Norway.
Harsh, Yancey sighed.
I'll get dressed. Then we should go.
The house on Fleming looked empty. Blister's common-law wife sat on the front step rolling a beer bottle in her palms. Her sad little bicycle lay in the front yard. She looked up and said,
Not you people again.
Where are Benny and the boys? Yancey asked.
I'm sorry he stabbed you, but that don't mean I owe you a conversation.
Clearoy ended up on Stoney's menu, just so you know.
Mona held up her chubby arms, cross-hatched with claw marks.
Take a good look and tell me why I should be all boo-hoo sad.
Mary said, Benny didn't tell you where he was going, did he? Now he won't even pick up his phone, I bet.
How'd you know?
Mona asked glumly.
Been there, honey.
To Yancey, Mona said,
I gotta ask you something. Is that the real Buck Nance my husband's hanging out with? Without the beard, it could be any damn jack-off.
No, that's Buck, the one and only.
Okay, but 50 grand a week? That's total bullshit, right? Benny was lying about that part for sure.
50 grand a week for doing what? Mary asked. She sat down beside Mona.
Hey, I like your flips.
Thanks, said Mona.
You a cop, too?
Mary patted her hand. Sheepishly, Mona related Blister's wild yarn about joining the cast of Bayou Brethren.
He said they was going to pay him $50,000 for every show, and he was going to be worldwide famous. I told him he had shit up to his eyeballs. So then he says, I can prove it, baby buns. Few days later, he calls to say his Hollywood agent rented a bungalow on Fleming. I gotta come right away. So I hump over there on my bike, and there's Benny and his so-called agent man and the dude they said was Buck Nance. And the three of them sit here all serious-faced, giving me a rundown on the big TV deal, how rich we're gonna be, and now, today, they're all gone.
She sucked a gloomy breath through the gaps in her teeth.
What's a normal woman supposed to think?
Mary said, Benny's not going to be a television star. He's going to prison.
With Captain Cockroach and giant ink all over his back? Dear God Almighty.
No kidding. You need to put that man in your rear view.
If only I could, said Mona.
Yancey went through the house and saw that the men had cleared out. The kitchen trash revealed that Buck remained faithful to the faves on his green room rider. Empty PBR cans, a Jack Daniels bottle, crumpled Fritos bags, Reese's wrappers, and handfuls upon handfuls of discarded, non-green M&Ms. The only sign of Blister was a grimy red bandana on the floor.
They've definitely vacated, Yancey said to Mona when he emerged. What are your plans?
He was my plan. Benny.
Mary said, He'll call eventually. There's no way he won't reach out to his baby buns.
Yeah, but then what?
Tell him the ride's over, honey. Tell him to give up.
Better yet, said Yancey, tell him to call me.
Mona heaved the beer bottle into some shrubs, righted her bicycle, and pedaled away. Mary drove Yancey to Mel Fisher's treasure museum, where she impressed him with her knowledge of shipwreck booty. She said she'd studied up on the Spanish fleets in preparation for a bogus artifacts hustle that she later scuttled.
It was a boyfriend's idea, Not Chip, but a different one. I was on quite a streak for a while. The dude scored a bunch of fake doubloons online from China and sold them as the real deal at these investment seminars in West Palm. But his favorite target was old retired couples, so I bailed on the scam, and on him too. I hear he's into reverse mortgages now.
Yancey said, "You want to go make out somewhere?"
"Well, aren't you the frisky one?"
He found a secluded parking spot under some trees near the cemetery. The car's back seat wasn't spacious enough for a horizontal fit, and the result was Yancey kicking out an armrest during a strenuous sequence of moves. Mary said she'd take it as a compliment. Afterward, they went to the Turtle Crawls for ceviche and boiled shrimp. Mary was in rare form, funny and flirty, keeping it light. To Yancey, she seemed happy, but then so had Rosa. Later, looking back on the afternoon, he couldn't think of anything he did or said that might have spooked Mary off. At the restaurant, she laughed so hard at one of his raunchy cop stories that her eyes were streaming. And she was definitely still smiling when she kissed him and told him she was going for a walk on the waterfront. She promised to meet him in an hour at Mallory Square. She told him to look for the iguana man. Yancey drove to the Stock Island jail to chat with the two South Beach bouncers, but they'd already made bail. He swung by Blister's duplex and wasn't surprised not to see the black Yukon. His final stop was a drop-in at Stoney's Crab Palace, where a wake of sorts was being held for a local biker who'd bought the farm at mile marker 19. Yancey wasn't cold-hearted enough to disrupt the ceremony with a kitchen inspection. He went back to town and left the car on Front Street. The original iguana man had died years earlier, but there was always at least one crusty imitator on the scene. He was easy to find, not only because he was cloaked with green lizards, but also because he was flocked by tourists who perceived the scaly creatures as exotic. In reality, South Florida was so overrun with the damn things that homeowners used high-powered pellet rifles to thin the herd. The local unpopularity of the reptiles was due to their appetite for delicate garden flowers and also their habit of prodigiously shitting in swimming pools. Yancey tracked down the iguana man du jour and scanned the selfie-snapping throng for Mary's face. Something poked him bluntly below the waist, and he looked down. An Irish setter was sociably nosing his crotch. When Yancey reached for its leash, the animal bolted with an air of goofy elation toward Whitehead and heavy traffic. Heedless of his stitches, Yancey ran after the dog. When he was a boy, he'd owned a golden retriever named Bowie that got run over by a delivery truck. Yancey still choked up whenever he thought about it. He sprinted as hard as he could after the footloose setter, which zigzagged crazily between honking taxis and tour buses. The chase went on until the fugitive veered down a dead-end alley where Yancey was able to corner and calm the animal. He beheld a pleasing vision of himself strolling through Mallory Square with a red-haired dog and a red-haired woman. But when he returned, there was no sign of Mary in the iguana man's crowd. Yancey called her phone, but she didn't answer. From behind him rose a cement mixer voice.
"Yo, that's my fucking mutt!"
Yancey turned and saw a burly, neckless figure carrying a suede shoulder bag. The man wore a new pastel fishing shirt and khaki hiking shorts that displayed, to no one's benefit, a bowed pair of pallid, hairy legs. Yancey handed over the leash. "That's a good-looking dog. What's his name?"
"John."
"Just plain old John?"
"I didn't fucking come up with it. That's what he answers to."
The man sounded weary of defending his pet's bland name.
"He must have took off while I was in the toilet. Thanks."
Yancey said, "No problem.
I needed the exercise. The man had a New York accent. He said he was visiting Key West on business.
This park is where everybody comes, right? To see the freaks and the sunset.
You're in the right place.
My girlfriend's floating around here somewheres.
Mine too, said Yancey, adding, a girl who's a friend.
They got phones. They know how to find us. You look like you could use a cold one.
Yancey was glad to leave the square, which had filled with meandering cruise ship googans. He told the man there was a pet-friendly bar on Simonton.
Fuck that. John goes where I go.
The man opened his shoulder bag and removed a blaze-orange vest, emblazoned with the words, Working Service Animal. He snapped the garment on the Irish setter and said,
Now you're legal, dumbass.
Yancey started laughing. I thought those dogs were trained not to run away.
John's got what you call impulse issues. Thank God I ain't blind. He'd drag my ass in front of a train.
Yancey took the man with the dog to the top of the La Concha. Mary still wasn't picking up her phone. After a couple of Heinekens, the man with the dog told Yancey that his name was Dominic and that he owned a document shredding business in Miami. It might have been true, though Yancey was doubtful. He told the man he was a health inspector. The rest was more small talk, two guys killing time. Despite the meatiness of his fingers, Dominic showed himself to be a nimble texter. He was visibly irritated because his girlfriend wasn't responding. Yancey changed the subject by inquiring if Dominic's family was involved in the shredding business. Dominic said only his son, Dom Jr., had shown any interest.
He's getting married in a few months in Staten Island, Dominic said. Great girl. He lucked out big time.
On his phone, Dominic proudly scrolled up a photograph of the couple, young Dom, a wide-bodied, spitting image of his old man. The raven-haired bride-to-be was all bosom and teeth, impossibly happy.
Check out the rock on her finger, said Dominic,
enlarging the screen image with his salami thumbs. Yancey looked closely at the engagement ring in the photo. He smiled and said, I'll be damned.
I gave it to Dommy to give to her. Take a guess what that thing's worth.
$200,000, said Yancey. The man named Dominic sat back, surprised.
Motherfucker, you're good.
Funny story about that diamond. Yancey told Dominic how it had come to end up in his refrigerator on Big Pine. Dominic slapped a hand on the bar and said,
Small fucking world.
Can I ask how you know that lawyer in Miami, Richardson?
Never met him. It was just a favor for a guy I'm sort of in business with.
Yancey said, Look, I don't want the ring back. It's not mine anyway. But can I say the gentleman you sent to my house really didn't have to kick me on their way out the door?
They told me you was a real smartass.
Man, I'd just gotten out of the hospital. Yancey lifted his shirt to show Dominic his belly wound.
Who the hell did that to you? Was it my guys?
No, not them.
They don't like the smartass routine, my guys. But tell you what.
Dominic glanced crossly at the dog, farting in its sleep between the bar stools.
You saved me some world-class poon by catching that runaway retard right there. My Guma, she'd never let me touch her again if I lost poor dumb adorable John. So I owe you one, is what I'm saying.
He handed Yancey a business card for a company called Rocco Gibraltar Document Disposal.
You ever need something, here's where to call.
Thanks for the beer, Yancey said. He felt better about the ring situation, knowing that Brock Richardson's diamond was a source of romantic joy for Dom Jr.'s fiancé, more joy than it had brought to either of the lawyer's fiancés. Yancey said goodbye to the mobster and walked to the elevator.
When the doors opened, a woman, who could only be Dominic's girlfriend, emerged. Her lips were cardinal red, her bleached platinum hair was trimmed severely short, and the cheeks of her formidable ass appeared to have been shaped with a helium nozzle. Despite her forward presentation, the woman seemed preoccupied as she brushed past Yancey on a high-heeled track to the bar. She was hurriedly repositioning a papaya scarf, though not before Yancey glimpsed upon her neck a florid, mouth-shaped mark that was too fresh to have been made by Dominic. Yancey stepped into the elevator and mashed the lobby button half a dozen times. Back at Mallory Square, he couldn't find Mary anywhere. Her phone went straight to voicemail. On a whim, he walked down to the Treasure Museum. She wasn't there. At dark, he drove back to Big Pine, knowing what he'd find. Mary's clothes and sandals and travel bag were gone from the house. Same for her toothbrush and scrunchies and the one-piece chrome swimsuit that drove him wild. He checked the refrigerator and saw that she'd also cleaned out her stash of energy drinks. Yancey felt worse about her leaving than he'd expected. He put on some Charlie Parker, smoked half a fatty, and fell asleep on his new couch. Early the next morning, he got up to go fishing, and that's when he found the square pink envelope she had placed on the casting deck of his boat. The note inside said, "I'm going to miss you, A.Y. Now quit dicking around and call Rosa." Chapter 21. Martin Trabeau, recklessly seeking to impress Big Noogie's girlfriend, bragged about his epic scheme to corner the market on Cuban beach sand.
"They'll jump all over this deal," he bubbled,
sprawled on his bed at the La Concha.
"They're going capitalist even faster than the damn Chinese."
Juveline told him to lie still. She was using a black Sharpie on his nutsack. It felt like she was drawing little hearts.
"There's a big meeting down in Havana," Trabeau said. "Muy importante."
"Yeah? Take me with you."
Trabeau thought she was joking.
"I never been to a real island," she said. "I want to go. Long Island doesn't count."
Looking down, Trabeau saw only the tinted crown of Juveline's noggin. He heard the felt tip of the Sharpie squeaking on his skin.
"Don't it tickle when I do this?" she asked.
"Sweetie, listen to me. Big Noogie will get suspicious if you're gone. This would never work. He'll kill the both of us."
"You serious? I've been on lots of trips, and the Noog don't care. 2-3 days sometimes he don't even call. Hey, what's that weird mark down here? That little purple V?"
"Ouch! Hey, careful."
"What is it, Marty? Tell me."
"That's where the Noog pinched me with hemostats."
"Hemo what?"
"Pliers. The kind they use in surgery."
"Holy shit, Marty, I bet that really hurt."
"That's the whole point of torture. Ask your boyfriend."
"Well," Juveline said, "if this don't cheer you up, nothing will."
She stood Trabeau in front of a full-length mirror and lifted his pecker to display her scrotal artwork.
"What exactly am I looking at?"
the Sandman asked.
"Emojis, you big dork."
"You mean like smiley faces?"
"One for each ball. See, they're blowing kisses," said Juveline. "Don't you ever text with emojis?"
At that moment, a more circumspect man might have paused to review the train of bad decisions that had brought him to such a precipice, screwing the girlfriend of a homicidal gangster while the gangster was out walking her dog. Trabeau, however, wasn't one to beat himself up. He truly believed he was cunning enough to snake through any brand of trouble. Regret was for suckers. Of course, it was foolhardy to fall for the crude charms of a high-maintenance flake like Juveline.
Yet, now that the dangerous line had been crossed, Trabeau was growing excited about the logistical challenges of long-term deceit. Dominic Aeola didn't seem like the brightest bulb in the chandelier.
If I want to, thought the Sandman, I can pull this off.
A wolf began howling, Big Noogie's ringtone on Juveline's phone. He left another message saying he was waiting in the hotel bar. Juveline played it back while she hurriedly put her clothes on. When Trabeau pointed out a florid hickey that he'd imprinted on her neck during lovemaking, she gave an airy shrug and reached for a scarf.
Trabeau said, "Maybe you should cover that suck mark with makeup."
"Do I look like the fucking Avon lady? All I got in my bag is lipstick."
"You're right, you're right. The scarf works."
Halfway out the door, Juveline turned and said,
"Text me tomorrow about Cuba, Marty. I need to know what to wear."
Trabeau had booked a seat on a charter flight from Miami to Havana by presenting himself as a renowned sculptor whose medium was, naturally, sand. He stated his trip to the communist country would be strictly educational, and on his application he attached photographs of elaborate Gothic castles, languid mermaids, and a medium-scale likeness of the space shuttle Atlantis. All these sand creations had been made one Saturday morning by fifth graders competing in a Floridays contest on Cocoa Beach. Their proud schoolteacher had posted the photos online without the precaution of watermarking, which allowed Trabeau to steal them and claim the sculptures as his own work. No one at the agency that booked his Cuba trip had displayed the slightest